talk about Danny Duffy's performance and the trade deadline yesterday and the Royals season in general is the play-by-play voice of the Kansas City Royals, Ryan Lefever. Ryan, how are you doing today, man?
I'm well. Good morning, Wade.
Good morning. Thanks for the time. We always appreciate it and always enjoy listening to you or watching you on television, wherever the case may be. I know you go back and forth between the two. And last night, you were on the radio calling Danny Duffy's performance. And is that the best or one of the best pitching performances you've ever seen in person?
Well, it's definitely one of the best. I got to broadcast a perfect game when I was in Minnesota, David Wells' perfect game in 1998. But as far as a dominant performance, I mean, the Rays, they had no chance. I mean, they hit a few balls hard. I want to say there were maybe two line drives to Paulo Orlando and then the double. So, I mean, you're talking about eight innings and three balls that were hit hard. I don't think there was a ground ball the whole game. I think everything was either a pop-up or a fly-out. And then the base hit. So in my mind, I mean, I was kind of in no-hit mode, you know, like, okay, get through the eighth inning here and make sure, you know, I've got all my ducks in a row to to call a no-hitter in the ninth because, man, it sure looked like he was going to get it.
He was so dominant, and one of the signs of being dominant to me is when you see major league hitters shaking their head at the plate, and that 35 swing and misses last night.
They had a great game plan, too. He and Salvador Perez, you know, they've been together since they were 18 years old in rookie ball. And the fastball clearly had some extra life to it last night. They just couldn't hit it. And they really, Salvi and Danny, really seemed to be in sync because there were a few occasions last night where it looked like the Rays were going to cheat, try and get ahead on that fastball. And they picked their spots perfectly. Danny would throw a breaking ball or he would throw a changeup. I mean, so there must have been a lot of discussions in the Rays dugout about, you know, man, what are you seeing? I mean, are you seeing that ball at all or what do we do? Because, I mean, they were just lost. And I was talking to some guys on the bus on the way back to the hotel last night and, you know, they were wondering, hey, was that a Royals record and who had the Royals record prior to that? And I was asking them, I mean, did you think he's going to get a no-hitter? And everyone seemed to think that the layoff that Danny had after the Royals came up with two runs in the eighth inning and the Rays made a pitching change, that, you know, that may or may not have been the reason why, you know, he didn't pitch as effectively to Desmond Jennings. His velocity appeared to be down in the eighth inning. But pitchers have a rhythm, and, you know, it's easier to withstand a longer delay when it's earlier in the game. But when you're at 97 pitches and, you know, the adrenaline's pumping because, you know, you're closing in on no-hitter, that probably wouldn't have been a bad idea for the Royals to go 1-2-3 and get Duffy right back out there. But, you know, that's hindsight. Who knows? It was still a start we'll never forget.
No, it was tremendous. And there's an interesting article on CBSSports.com about what could have been for Danny Duffy. They were saying that if Duffy would have completed the no-hitter, and we know he had 16 strikeouts, and he might have had more had he pitched the ninth inning and had the no-hitter intact, only seven times has a pitcher thrown a no-hitter while also striking out 15 or more batters. Nolan Ryan did it three times. Max Scherzer, Warren Spahn, Don Wilson, and Clayton Kershaw did it once. And the record for strikeouts in conjunction with a no-hitter is 17 by Nolan Ryan and Max Scherzer. Duffy, certainly, I mean, he had the stuff. He struck out the last two there in the eighth. He could have been very close to setting a record for most strikeouts by a pitcher with a no-hitter. That was how close he was to Major League Baseball history.
Yeah, I mean, just when I was talking to Chris Young, who's been around for a long time, and, you know, he's saying that's the most dominant performance he's ever seen. And he's seen a lot of good pitching in his career. You know, he pitched in Seattle with Felix Hernandez. And so I think sometimes we're in our own little bubble here and we don't realize the historical significance of certain accomplishments. So we think, wow, one of the most dominant performances. Then you think, well, 16 strikeouts and one hit over eight innings and one walk. I mean, why not is that one of the most dominant performances? And, you know, we're talking about 48 years of Royals history and some pretty good pitching along the way, and nobody has struck out more than Danny Duffy did last night. So, you know, there will come a time, maybe sooner rather than later, where someone will be you know, they'll have 10 strikeouts after five innings, and we'll flip through the media guide and say, you know, what was the Royals record? Oh yeah, remember that 16 strikeout game that Duffy had in Tampa Bay? So that will and I mean it's more fresh in my mind. I remember Zach Greinke's 15 strikeout game against Cleveland, but I remember very few of the details. I mean, nothing really stands out other than, you know, he got the record and got an ovation. But I don't remember anything else about that game. But I think I'm going to remember Duffy's start last night for a long time.
It was an amazing performance. Ryan LaFever, the voice of the Kansas City Royals, our guest today on the Sports Ticket, brought to you by Crossroads Bar and Grill in Downs. It is also amazing from the standpoint that this is a guy that wasn't even in the Royals rotation, trying to figure out where he fit in the bullpen before the season. And now it seems almost laughable. And I mean, if somebody woke up today or wasn't around during spring training, they'd have to sit here and go, what were the Royals thinking? Why wasn't Duffy in the rotation? The Royals rotation has been such in flux and hasn't been very good all year long, and this guy's clearly their best pitcher. It is very remarkable to me to see how far Danny Duffy has come from the beginning of the season when you're trying to find a role for him in the pen to being, quite honestly, he is the ace of the Royals staff, no question, and maybe you can put him in the category of he is a Major League Baseball ace if he keeps pitching like he did last night.
Well, I don't think he is where he is right now without that trip to the bullpen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we saw the same thing with Zach Greinke. You know, Zach was a completely different starter after he went to the bullpen than he was before he went to the bullpen. And he was more of an attacking pitcher as opposed to a finessing movement type of a pitcher. And, you know, Danny's always had the arm, but the approach needed to change. And by setting him to the bullpen and just giving him one inning at a time, maybe two innings, Dave Island told him when he went back into the starting rotation, because Duffy's thinking, okay, can I still pitch the same now as I did out of the bullpen? Or do I have to start pacing myself? Do I have to start setting up hitters early in the game so I can put them away later in the game? And that kind of thinking is what got him into trouble the first time he was a starter. And that's the kind of thinking that got Zach Greinke into trouble when he was first a starter. And Dave Island said something to Danny Duffy this time around and said, just win this inning. Just win the inning that you're in. Don't worry about the next inning because you may get, you know, your block knocked off and you're not even in the next inning. So don't worry about it. Just win this inning. And that really clicked with him. And I learned this from Paul Splittorff. Paul Splittorff used to say that basically pitching coaches and hitting coaches are teaching the same things, but they can word it differently. The best ones learn their pitcher's personality and they adjust accordingly. And that resonated with Danny Duffy. Just win this inning. Don't worry about the next inning. Just be on the attack and win this inning. Now, you know, I don't want to call it a consequence, but consequently, the Royals took a long time to stretch out Danny Duffy because they knew that this was a different effort level. And typically you can expect 10 for sure, 15 probably, maybe 17 or 18 additional pitches with each start as a guy is building up stamina. But they were much more conservative with Danny. And so it was a gradual build getting back to 100-plus pitches as a starter if you look back on his return to the starting rotation. So that proved to be very beneficial for him to go to the bullpen and simplify his mechanics. He's pitching exclusively out of the stretch, simplify his pitches. I think pitching out of the bullpen and only having to face 3, 4, 5 hitters made him realize, man, I can attack with my fastball here. And then he realized guys couldn't hit his fastball. So all this important information registered with him, and then here he is as a starter basically pitching like he did out of the bullpen, but much different from the first time he was a starting pitcher.
So one thing that I have really appreciated with Dayton Moore, and this kind of ties in with the trade deadline yesterday, is that Dayton Moore has been very patient with various players. I mean, we can go through it. Mike Moustakas, he was patient with. Alex Gordon, he was patient with. And certainly Danny Duffy, he has been patient with. And a lot of people want to get rid of a guy when he's struggling. Well, let's just trade him. He's not going to work out. Well, good thing we held on to those guys. And the next guy that I think falls in that category that the Royals have been extremely patient with is Yordano Ventura. And I wonder about Ventura because if he just looks at Danny Duffy they're both in a similar boat. In fact, probably Duffy was in a worse boat than Ventura was the last year or so, is that Danny Duffy, to me, has learned how to pitch instead of throw. I remember Nolan Ryan talking about what happened, what really got you going in your big league career. And he mentioned, at a certain point in time, I learned, instead of just throwing hard, I learned how to pitch. And there's a huge difference. When I'm watching Yordan Ventura, many times I watch him and I'm thinking, he's throwing, he's not pitching. I watched Duffy last night. That's called pitching. He used all three of his pitches. He spotted him where he wanted. Salvi was setting up exactly where he wanted. They were on the same page. But Ventura, sometimes, it's I don't know if it's machismo or whatever it is, he wants to blow one by a guy, and these major league hitters can hit that high fastball at 97, 98 miles an hour. Do you think what Danny Duffy's doing here can rub off on Yordan Ventura and go, wow, if Danny can do this when he wasn't even in the rotation to start the year, why can't Yordan Ventura? And for the fans out there, can we have maybe a little bit more patience going, this is what happened when we waited on Duffy. Perhaps that can happen with Yordano.
Well, and the Royals have Yordan Ventura signed for 3 more years. And so, I mean, it's wise to be patient with him. And, yeah, I mean, the only different words I would use compared to what you said, and I've, as long as I've been doing this, I see things through a different lens every now and then, and I go, oh, okay, here's what's going on here. So this is what's clicked with me. Danny Duffy, to your point that he's learned how to pitch, Danny Duffy is at a point now where he wants to get hitters out. Mm-hmm. He just wants to get them out. Yordan Ventura is still at a stage of his career where every now and then he wants to embarrass the hitter.
Yeah.
He wants to blow him away. He wants to make him look bad. And as a result, he overthrows and, you know, he'll go from 0-2 to 3-2, or rather than worrying about location, he's throwing it as hard as he can, and the ball ends up over the middle of the plate, and he gets hurt. But I think he's getting there. If you look at his last few starts, I think he's getting there. And I would hope that Danny Duffy would rub off on him, because Yordano Ventura wants to be that guy. I mean, Yordano Ventura pitched that impressive Game 6 of the World Series a couple of years ago. He got a contract out of it, and he was the opening day starter out of it. And he's not that guy anymore. He's just another guy in the rotation. And so, I mean, you would hope that he's watching what Danny Duffy has done, and that's probably the last adjustment that Yordano Ventura needs to make.
Ryan LaFever, the voice of the Royals, with us today on the Sports Ticket. So the trade deadline was yesterday, and reading from some of my Royals friends, a little bit upset that the Royals didn't make some big moves. Of course, the biggest names for the Royals was Edison Volquez, Kendrys Morales, and then, of course, Wade Davis, which all the trade speculation ended once he went back on the DL. I look at the track record. Dayton Moore in 2014 didn't do much, and everybody was critical, and that worked out okay for the Royals standing pat. Last year, he did make the big splash. He traded for Zobrist, traded for Cueto, and they were big pieces of the puzzle to win a World Series championship. What were you hearing the last few days, and are you surprised at all, or is this what you expected, that the Royals, other than the Brett Eibner for Billy Burns trade, really didn't do anything at the trade deadline?
Mm-hmm. Yes and no. I mean, I guess I was surprised because I figured the Royals had some valuable pieces that they could potentially trade away to another team and help, you know, replenish the farm system, because the Royals, you know, they've gone through some prospects to win the World Series last year. And as I'm talking, I'm kind of flipping through on my computer here all of the trades that were made yesterday. And then when I say I'm not surprised, is there were very few starting pitchers who moved.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Matt Moore went from Tampa Bay to San Francisco. The Blue Jays and the Pirates swapped guys, Liriano and Hutchison. And I'm trying to think of what other starting pitchers moved at the deadline. And I guess
Cashner from the Padres.
Okay, Cashner a few days prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the moral of the story is teams are using the Royals' formula here. They're trying to strengthen their bullpen.
Mm-hmm.
I had never experienced the postseason as closely as I did in 2014. All the Royals' bad years, the season was over. I didn't want to watch baseball for a while, and I'd kind of, from, you know, I wanted to know who won every day, but to actually sit and watch a game and you know, in my own mind, analyze the game or just you know, comprehend how a manager gets through a postseason, I just didn't pay attention. And then the Royals go to the postseason, and I realize, wow, starting pitching is really important during the regular season. But in the postseason, it's not as important as it is in the regular season because, I mean, if your starter doesn't have it in the postseason, I mean, you need to get him out of there. There's no, well, you know, we got to get innings out of him. We got to save the rest of the rotation. We got to save the bullpen. I mean, that's all out the window. If your starter's having a good game, great. If he's not, you can pull him in the fourth inning as long as you have a good bullpen. And if you have a good bullpen, just the format of the playoffs, you're always going to have a rested bullpen because only twice in the entire postseason is there the potential of having three games in a row. You have all those built-in off days. Mm-hmm. The Royals in 2014 had those two sweeps, so they had 4 days off between the division series and the championship series, and they had 5 days off between the championship series and the World Series. And I thought, wow, okay, I hadn't realized this. So there were a lot more relievers that went from team to team than there were starters. So back to your original question, I guess, I just assumed that the Royals, you know, might trade Edinson Volquez or they might trade Kendrys Morales or, you know, they might trade one of their relievers or even, you know, trade somebody like Jerod Dyson because another team might like to have him come off the bench. But then I look at all the other moves that were made and it's like, okay, I see how teams are trying to get ready. They need some more offense because you have to have hitters that can hit good pitching in the postseason because that's all you're going to see is good pitching in the postseason. And they want to stack their bullpen. So in the end, I it made sense. You know, and Dayton says something, he said something for years and he's reiterated again this year, is that, you know, winning is premium to them. So you can look at the Royals now and say they're 11 games out and they're not going to make it to the postseason this year. And maybe you're right, but winning games is still important. And so if you have some sort of a fire sale and you start trading guys off and then your season goes right down the drain, you know, you've got a lot of young players who are going to be called up in September or maybe even before September. And the Royals have created a winning culture. And you can't just turn it off and say, okay, you know, we're just going to turn off our winning culture here for the next 2 months and then pick it back up again next April. That doesn't work. And so I think in the end, winning games is still important, even if right now the goal is just to finish above 500 or finish in second place or, you know, it would be great if they could, you know, get back into the hunt again. So take all that information, you cobble it together, and then I can sit back and go, you know what, I can see why they didn't make any moves. And if there was a move that would really help the Royals, they would have made it.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what Dayton was basically saying. There just wasn't anything out there that would drastically improve our baseball team at the trade deadline. And we know that the Royals, I mean, they've had problems with starting pitching, and every fifth day is an adventure with the fifth spot. And if Edinson Volquez is traded, you're obviously waving a white flag this year. And then how does it impact you next year? It's not like the Royals have a whole bunch of young guys in the minor league system that are ready to slide in to take a Edison Volquez's spot. So perhaps he'll be on the team again next year. I wanted to ask you about Eric Hosmer because you were talking about the winning culture, and he's certainly, you know, I think it's Salvi and Eric as the two leaders of this team, although I think Alex Gordon is one of those maybe lead by example type of guys, and that's why it was so important for them to re-sign him. But the Royals, when we look at the way the contracts have been set up with Ian Kennedy as a free agent, with Alex Gordon, redid the deal with Salvador Perez, you look at a lot of the money the Royals have on the books, a lot of it is escalating into the back years of their contracts in 2018, 19, and 20. And you look at the guys that are going to be free agents at the end of next year, Hosmer, Kane, and others. And it does seem that this is maybe the window. The 2017 is that last year of the window for the Royals to maybe contend for a World Series championship. So thus, 16 might be about done. We have to turn our attention to 2017. Having said that, when you do that, and if it doesn't work out, we could be in a weird situation at All-Star break next year if the Royals are out of it. Because then we could be seeing perhaps that fire sale that you mentioned earlier. And that leads me to the question. Eric Hosmer will be a free agent end of next year. What are you hearing with Hosmer and the Royals as to are they really negotiating? I mean, they probably don't give you too much information, but can they afford to do a deal with Hosmer where reports of 8 years, $200 million, 9, 10 years, $200 million, would that be a wise decision for the Royals as a small market team to invest that much money into one player? Because we've already seen Alex Gordon, 4 years, $72 million. The early returns are that that's a bad contract. He could turn around the next 3 years. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's a lot to that question. I'll begin with, I don't like this talk about, you know, this is this, you know, this small window the Royals are in. And after 2017, you know, oh boy, we're going to have to start all over again. I don't think the Royals see it that way. Now, if you look at it the way you did, it makes sense because of all the guys that are going to be free agents. And this kind of goes back to the previous question of why the Royals didn't make a bunch of trades at the deadline yesterday, is they want to win as much as they can this year and next year and hope that it carries over into 18 and 19, you know, with, you know, whomever is on this team. If you look at the standings, Wade, the bottom of the American League East, the American League Central, the American League West, the National League East, and the National League Central, those teams were at the top not that long ago. 4, 5, 6 years ago, all those teams were at the top of their divisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the rub. You want to win now, but you look at those teams and you can see they signed players to long-term contracts that they shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to hang on one more year. You know, they didn't know when to let go. And now all of a sudden you're at the bottom and you're rebuilding and you're starting all over again. And I know the Royals do not want to do that. No team wants to do that.
Right.
But I don't. 29 years without the postseason and 11 out of 14 years with 90 or more losses was dreadful. And they don't want to go back to that again. And I don't think the fans want to go back to that again. So I think they want to find a way to stay competitive even after 2017. So do you put all your eggs in 17's basket and then you're shot for 4, 5, 6 years after that?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you put some of your eggs in 2017 and stay competitive in 18 and 19 and beyond? So that's the first thing that I believe. And I don't this desperation to, you know, get something done for next year because it's all over after next year, I don't buy into that. To me, this is Eric Hosmer's team, and Salvador Perez is a leader in his way. Alex Gordon is a leader in his way. There are plenty of leaders. Wade Davis is a leader. Chris Young is a leader. But this is Eric Hosmer's team, and I think that really started to take form early in the 2015 season. He's the kind of guy that you say, okay, Let's build this team around him and his personality. Chesler Cuthbert, I think, is playing really well because of Eric Hosmer. Not only because of Eric Hosmer, but Hosmer's fingerprints are all over Chesler Cuthbert. Whit Merrifield played well for a while. Brett Eibner had his contributions. They come up to the big leagues, and Eric Hosmer just kind of wraps his arm around these guys and takes them out to eat and makes them feel like big leaguers, makes them feel like they belong. He's the guy that I think you could invest in long-term. Now the third part of the question, how long-term do you want to go?
Yeah.
We were having this discussion the other day at dinner before one of the games, and this is my opinion, and you can think about it, your listeners can think about it, and maybe we can have another discussion about this down the road. Of all the mega contracts, and when I say mega, I'm saying, you know, we're talking about $100 or more million dollars in, let's say, 7 years or more. Of all the mega contracts, and I can remember, I can only think of three that when it was all said and done, the team was satisfied with that contract. It was a good deal for both sides. It was a good deal financially, even if it was below market. If anybody in this country can make $100 million in fewer than 10 years, I don't care what the market says. If that's not a good deal, we got a problem. but when it was all said and done, the team was happy with the contract. The team was satisfied with the contract. The player not only performed, but the player finished in their uniform. I mean, a lot of these contracts, the guy ends up somewhere else, and two or three teams are paying the guy's salary. To me, that's not a good contract. And the three I've come up with were Derek Jeter's original contract.
Okay.
Albert Pujols' first contract with the Cardinals, and Barry Bonds' last contract with the Giants. I think when those were all said and done, those three teams were happy. And I don't know if they were $100 million, but at the time, they were mega long-term contracts. The other ones, and maybe there are more, and if someone can come up with another one, I'd love to add somebody to the list. So So history will tell you that once you get into that stratosphere, more times than not, significantly more times than not, it's player friendly, it's not team friendly. And now you go to the last facet of the question, what market are the Royals in?
Mm-hmm.
And the Royals are in one of the smallest markets in baseball. The Royals could win the World Series this year, next year, and the year after that. That'd be five straight appearances in the World Series. And that would be great. But 6 million people are not going to move to Kansas City. You're not going to have the revenue streams that New York has or Los Angeles has or Chicago has or Dallas has or Philadelphia or wherever, Boston, you name it. That's just the reality of it. And the Royals are making more money. Their television ratings are up. The attendance is up. But you're limited. They're limited financially. And Mr. Glass is an extremely wealthy man, but he's also a very wise businessman. So it's a complicated question. It's a very complicated question. And the knee-jerk reaction is to say, yeah, sign Eric Hosmer. Mm-hmm. And I think Eric would stay here. I don't think Eric has his heart set on New York or, the bright lights of a large market like most people do. I mean, I think, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for him when he becomes a free agent. But I think he'd stay here. I really think he would stay here. And I don't think you'd have to compete with New York and Boston and Los Angeles dollars to keep him here. But boy, do you have to be careful when you go there. I mean, the Minnesota Twins, they had to sign Joe Mauer. You can't not sign Joe Mauer.
Exactly.
He's from Minnesota. He's won three batting titles. He's won an MVP. He hit 29 home runs. I mean, you have to sign Joe Mauer. They could not let him go elsewhere. Well, I mean, that thing is just an anchor in that organization now. So, very long answer to your very complicated question.
It was a long question, I'll give you that. Now, how much do you think the Alex Gordon contract could impact the Eric Hosmer contract? And the reason I bring this up is what I said earlier. Alex Gordon knows as well as anybody. He has really struggled. He's striking out at a high rate. I did the research the other day. People think of Mark Trumbo as a strikeout hitter, a feast or famine type of guy. Hits a lot of home runs, strikes out a lot. He's striking out 28% of the time. Alex Gordon's striking out 33% of the time. And that alarmed me because I was like, man, he's striking out a lot. But nobody talks about Alex Gordon being a guy that strikes out a ton, it doesn't seem. And the numbers are not good at all. Do you think that that contract, and because 4 years, $72 million, I know Alex is older than Eric Hosmer, could impact the Glass family a little bit before wanting to make that commitment to Eric Hosmer? And then the second part of my question is, why do you think Alex Gordon has struggled so much this year? Is he putting too much pressure on himself?
Well, the first part, I don't know if it's going to impact him financially. It might. It probably will a little bit. It may just more impact them emotionally more than anything else. I mean, the Royals don't give out contracts like that.
Yeah.
And a little off topic, the Minnesota Twins are a fascinating case study, and it applies to the Royals. And we kept close track of them because they were in our division. They're in a bigger market. Minneapolis is a significantly bigger market than Kansas City is. But when they were in the Metrodome, their situation was pretty similar when it came to revenue. And Minnesota had a lot of homegrown players. They got to the playoffs. They went to the playoffs for many years. They were limited financially. So as a result, they had to keep their farm system strong. And when certain guys got to a point where they were too expensive, they were forced to trade them or let them walk as a free agent. But they had somebody come up from the minor leagues and replace them. And I have friends from college that were upset all the time. The Twins wouldn't spend money or they wouldn't, the Twins would never go out and get Johnny Cueto or Ben Zobrist.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went and they got bumped out of the, I think they won six divisions over 9 years and went to pass the first round one time.
Yep.
And the complaint was, why don't they go out there and make a move? Well, that was their philosophy at the time, but they won. They won a lot. Well, now they move into Target Field and money's fallen out of the sky. Now they can sign Joe Mauer. Now they can sign Michael Kadire. Now they can sign Justin Morneau and Joe Nathan and Nick Blackburn and Scott Baker and on. And it sunk them. They got away from who they were. And now they have to rebuild. The Royals have to remember who they are. And they're making more money, as I said. They're in a better position financially. They'll be in a great position financially when they get their new television deal. But they've done a really good job, I think, of remembering who they are. So Alex Gordon got a lot of money, but it's a 4-year contract. It's not a 7-year contract. It's not an 8-year contract.
Mm-hmm.
So why is he struggling this year? My personal opinion is, number one, I don't know if he felt like he was going to come back this year. I think he figured he was going to go somewhere else because the Royals just couldn't afford him. And I think in his mind, whatever the Royals would have given him, he would have considered. I never thought Alex would take more money to go to a team like the White Sox, a dysfunctional organization that just brings in people and they can't win and there's always clubhouse issues. And that's not Alex Gordon. I also don't think Alex would go to a big market just to cash in. I mean, that's just not, that's not the Alex Gordon that I know. And so when the Royals gave him the contract that they gave him, I mean, I think he and his wife Jamie were just over the moon. They couldn't believe they get to stay in Kansas City and the Royals invested that much money in him. And knowing Alex, Alex is a, you know, you work harder rather than rest.
Right.
I think he just puts so much energy and effort and stock into the season that he probably was trying too hard and was trying to do more things than Alex Gordon is capable of doing. Then he gets hurt, and now there's the second part of his problem this year. I mean, he broke his wrist.
Mm-hmm.
And any time a player breaks his wrist or breaks his hand, when you come back, it takes a long time to build up that strength. Last year, Edinson Volquez broke George Springer's wrist for the Astros, and he was out long enough for the wrist to heal and get back into games, but he wasn't the same. And Rex Hudler went down and had a conversation with him prior to the Royals playing the Astros and prior to Volquez facing the Astros again, and talked to George Springer. And Springer said it took him the whole rest of the season and the offseason for his wrist and his hands to feel normal again. Kevin Kiermaier, the center fielder for the Rays, really good player. He's been really bad since coming back from a broken hand. So I think now Alex wasn't hitting before he got hurt, but it's just, I think it's just, he needs for this season to be over with.
Yeah.
And just hit the reset button, and I think Alex is going to, I don't know if Alex is going to have an all-star season when he comes back next year, but I'm pretty confident he's going to come back next year and be a completely different guy, because what he did and the pressure he put on himself this year clearly did not work. But as Ned has said and other people have said, it's not like Alex forgot how to hit in 1 year. I mean, mm-hmm. he still knows how to hit, but he had a, you know, pretty serious injury last year when he you know, tore his groin or pulled his groin badly or whatever. Now he has a broken wrist. Let's start judging Alex when 2017 begins.
Ryan LaFever, the voice of Kansas City Royals, our guest today on the Sports Ticket. Two more questions for you, Ryan. We'll let you go. I appreciate the time as always. Do you think the long postseasons the last 2 years have caught up to the Royals? And I say that because of all of the injuries the Royals have suffered this year.
I think so. I mean, I know people with the Giants, and the Giants would say there's a reason why they didn't go to the playoffs in between World Series championships. I mean, they were just gassed. I mean, physically, emotionally, it's hard. And in fact, one of those years, they were below 500 and then came back and won the World Series the next year. And 1 year, it was Buster Posey getting injured, and they just weren't the same. So, and I think Buster Posey and Madison Bumgarner said exactly that at the All-Star game this year, that they were, how impressed they were that the Royals could lose Game 7 of the World Series and then come back and win the World Series, because they were never able to do that. And I've heard that from a lot of people, that there is a World Series hangover, and especially a World Series championship hangover, mm-hmm. because the off-season is shorter, and you have all these appearances that you need to make, and people are tugging you here and there. It's a different off-season. Then you get to spring training, and you got SportsCenter set up there. You've got the MLB Network set up there. I mean, just all of these interview requests. It's just not a normal off season. And so, you know, to go 3 in a row is so rare. And the last team to do it was the Yankees. But I mean, that team was filled with veterans and superstars. They knew how to handle all that. I mean, that was nothing. They were the Yankees. I mean, whether they won the World Series or not, there was just going to be a huge amount of attention. So they were accustomed to it. So I absolutely think this has something to do with it. It's not an effort issue. It's just an energy issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, Wade, you can get in your car and you can start driving to Kansas City, You know, but if you got a quarter tank of gas, I'm sorry, man. I don't care how badly you and your car want to get to Kansas City. You're going to run out of gas. Yeah. I mean, you got to fill up. And the Royals just have not had time to fill up like they have in years past.
And that's what makes what they did last year to me even more remarkable, because if you were a betting man, you would have said, well, there's no way the Royals are going to go back to the World Series because of the things you just said, the long run in the postseason, all the way to Game 7, and they set the goal, hey, we're going to finish this thing, unfinished business. And for them to have that focus for an entire season, get back there, and then win it, on top of being there the year before, I think a lot of people take it for granted that, oh, hey, you know, after 29 years, now we back-to-back years, well, the Royals are just supposed to be in the playoffs every year. It's hard to get there. It's hard to get there. It's hard to win it, but it's hard to even get there to get in the tournament to win it.
Right. I mean, we could easily be talking right now about the Royals. Hey, you know what? They made it to the wild card in 2014. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Gosh, that was fun. And last year, well, they almost won the division series with the Astros. You know, they got past the wild card, and now they got to the division series.
Yeah.
Great accomplishment. I mean, because they should have lost two games.
Absolutely.
I mean, they could easily. That's all they could be talking about.
Yes.
You know, but you know, they got to back-to-back World Series. And Ned used, you know, when Ned talked about the Royals being able to bounce back, he said, you know, he used that Mount Everest analogy, which I thought was a good one. You know, you get to Mount Everest and you put in all the time, and you're a step from reaching the peak, and you slip and you slide down to the bottom of the mountain again. And it's like, man, I was one step away.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't 20 steps away. If they had won the wild card and lost to the Angels 2 years ago, they were a long way away from the World Series.
Right.
But they were they were 90 feet away from getting to the top of the mountain. That will tell you that you can do it, okay? Now when you get to the top of the mountain, it takes a lot out of you to get to the top of the mountain. And again, this is not an effort issue, and I don't want it to come across that way, but they're trying just as hard to get back to the top of the mountain. But when they slip and they fall down, it's like, we've been up there, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe this isn't the time. Maybe we need to recharge and try it again next year. I mean, it says nothing about the character of this team. It's just human nature. It's not just baseball. It's everything else in life.
No, I agree with you there. All right, final question. Well, you went to the did you go to the White House?
I did.
All right. So I need you to tell me and all of our listeners out there something unique or different or something that surprised you when you were at the White House.
The Secret Service was the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. So you got to go through three different security checkpoints to get into the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And then we come in from the inside the White House. We come in from through the basement. So we got to see like the China room and the parlor room and the men's cigar room or whatever in down in the basement of the White House, and you hear the history of it. And so then you come up these stairs, and it leads you to the entrance of the White House, which is the main entrance inside the front doors. And it's much smaller than you think it would be, but there's that red carpeted staircase that goes to the second floor, and that's where the residence is. And there's a Secret Service guy standing right in the middle of the stairs looking at you like if you made one bad move, he would obliterate you with some sort of laser gun that he has. I mean, it's just bad-looking dude. So this isn't a security guy who's just making sure that, you know, order is restored, and then if everything seems to be under control, that he kind of lets his guard down. I mean, this guy was serious. Okay, so then we go sit down, and we wait for the White House to come in and greet the Royals. And are you hearing that static, by the way?
Yeah, a little bit, but it's not too bad.
Okay, sorry about that. It's my phone here. So then the president walks in, and I'm sure there was security all over that room. But the ones that I noticed, the president is at the podium, the team and the staff are behind him, and then on each side of the team are these Secret Service guys. So I'm watching the president, I'm watching these Secret Service guys, and their heads are just on this swivel the whole time, just scanning the room, you know. I was almost tempted just kind of want to, like, stand up in my chair and just see what, you know, they wouldn't come tackle me, but just how they would react. But I whispered it to my wife. And I won't tell you what her response was, but
I bet I know what it probably was.
Clearly
like.
Did not motivate me to do it.
Yes.
And then I could tell when the president was done, And he shook Dayton's hand, he shook Ned's hand, and they gave him his jersey. He comes back to the podium, and I saw him kind of do a little subtle nod toward the side of the room. And then he went to the front row, and he greeted, you know, Mayor Sly James was there, and he just, you know, greeted everyone in the front row. Emmanuel Cleaver was there, and then he ends up with Josh Earnest and his wife and their son. And I thought, you know what, he's nodding. He's letting them know that he's leaving the podium and going to shake hands. This probably has to be all planned. So he's done with Josh Earnest, and then he nods again. And I notice the Secret Service guys, they start talking into their wrists. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they're telling each other, get ready, the president. And I'm wondering how many guys are hearing this. And the president gets up, and he nods, and he goes, and they follow him out the room. And I just thought, that was really cool. I mean, that was just, this is the most protected man in the world. And I was just thinking, you know, how bad are these dudes that are get to accompany the president and protect the president right next to him?
Mm-hmm.
So, sorry for going on and on there, no. But I mean, that's all I could think about was the Secret Service.
Well, I have one of
the coolest things I've ever seen.
I have a good friend of mine. He used to be in the Secret Service, and he has told me a few stories. And some stuff he still can't even talk about, you know? He's got to take that to the grave. But let's just say he could write a really interesting book, I can tell you.
Oh, they all could.
Yeah.
I just thought, man, for 8 years, you know, the president has learned how to communicate with the Secret Service. Because I've heard from Secret Service that what drives them crazy the most, and maybe your friends told you this, is when they go off script.
Yep.
And the president wants to get out of the car, the motorcade, and shake hands. I mean, it's scary. You know, that's frightening because they're vulnerable when that happens.
Absolutely.
And we were just in Dallas on the last road trip, and, you know, President Kennedy didn't want the bubble on top of his car because he wanted to be able to be accessible to the people. And so then all just a little subtle move to let them know so that they can be prepared and they can change their focus from one area of the room to the other. And because, you know, the president got in, he was very engaging. I've seen him on TV a million times, and he just kind of felt like you knew him because you'd seen him on TV, and he gave a great speech. And but then again, it's like you remember who this guy is and how protected he is and how every move is marked out. And so that was just fascinating to me.
You had to feel like you're living in a dream where, like, somebody had to pinch you, right? I mean,
yeah, it was. And then we got on a plane and went home. And by 5 o'clock that night, I was in flip flops and shorts and a T-shirt taking my son to an activity at church. And someone came up to me and said, "Oh man, I thought you would have gone to the White House today." I did. I mean, I'm already home. I mean, it was. My wife and I, we went to bed that night. I was like, we did go to the White House today, didn't we? Weren't we at the White House? That did happen, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So, that's awesome. Yeah. That's one of the perks of the job, right? You're the voice of the World Series champs. You get to go to the White House. That's pretty nice.
It was cool. It was really, really neat. Wow. Politics aside, man, it was just an honor to, you know, to be in the White House and see all those portraits that you've seen on mm-hmm. TV before and all those rooms where so many diplomats and presidents from other countries have been greeted, and you've seen on CNN or Fox or MSNBC or your local news or whatever. I mean, just to be sitting in those rooms and sitting in those chairs, you know, it was just really an honor.
Did they take away your electronic devices and everything?
We could take pictures. President walked in. I have pictures that I took on my phone of the president walking in. So
cool.
Now you have to go through three different, you know, points of security to get in there.
Right.
But it was, they encouraged. They didn't want you to take videos, but they said, if you want to take pictures, you go right ahead.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, hey, man, I'm so happy for you to have that experience. That is so awesome. Certainly one of the pinnacles of your career that you'll never forget. And we appreciate your time as always. And, hey, let's turn the season around. Let's do something that people don't expect. Let's have the Royals make a run here late this season and push into 2017.
You got it. All right, Wade.
Thanks, Ryan. Take care, man.
Okay, bud.
That's Ryan LaFever, the voice of the Kansas City Royals. Our guest today on the Sports Ticket, brought to you by Crossroads Bar and Grill and Downs.